Five, four, three, two, one.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs the radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
Greetings, one and all, to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. My name is Jason Barrett. This is where sports media conversation takes center stage. My thanks to all of you who listened to last week's episode featuring Josh Innes. I thought we covered a lot of ground on that episode. If you haven't had a chance yet to listen to it, I encourage you to do so when time allows. Today on the podcast, I'll be speaking with Joe Fortenbaugh of 95.7 The Game in San Francisco, my former home. Joe hosts The Morning Show alongside former NFL fullback Lorenzo Neal and the very funny Dan Dibley. You could hear their show by streaming online at 957thegame.com or just download the app or tell Alexa to play it. I would like to ask two small favors of you. First, if you're listening on iTunes, please subscribe and leave a review. Secondly, I've added a new business page for Barrett Sports Media on Facebook. If you use Facebook and you're not following the page, take a few seconds to check it out and give us a like. It's that simple. Now, on last week's episode, I began by introducing a new feature called the 5 and 5. Essentially, it's 5 topics in 5 minutes. It goes a little something like this.
There are 5 minutes remaining.
Add Vice Sports to the list of brands who have turned a cold shoulder to the written word. The company cut 2% of their workforce last week by eliminating writers and editors in favor of original video content. Now, this seems to be a growing trend as Vice has followed the same path that FS1 and MTV took. Video is easier to monetize, and numerous researchers point out that public interest in visual content attracts more eyeballs than written material. That may be true in some cases, but suggesting that American sports fans don't like to read is an insult. There's room for both platforms to thrive in this universe. Vice, however, doesn't agree. Fortunately, you get a say in the matter, and that's done by spending less time consuming Vice Sports' digital content. What Vice Sports doesn't value, The Athletic and Boston Sports Journal certainly do. If you haven't checked out either of these new digital sites, I invite you to do so. They're designed well, locally focused, and they've invested in talented writers with excellent credibility in their respective cities. One big difference, though, is that each are hoping the public demand for quality content will be strong enough to warrant paid subscriptions. Now, some are going to say this represents a fundamental change in the way media operators are doing business. But is it really any different than what the print business was built on? We did once pay daily, weekly, and monthly for newspapers. Will there be enough consumer demand to support paid written platforms? I'm not sure. But as we've seen time after time, great content attracts an audience. I wish The Athletic and Boston Sports Journal the very best in their endeavors. I pointed out last week how disinterested I was in the O.J. Simpson parole hearing, and judging from the ratings, the public watched, but not on sports television. A combined 7 networks aired the hearing. The total rating was a 9.4. ESPN, though, had the lowest rating at 0.4. And what that should tell you is that the sports media sometimes love stories like this because they provide drama and content during slower periods, but what we value and discuss with one another isn't always what the public cares to hear about on sports radio or TV. O.J. Simpson is simply clickbait. He's 70 years old, has been in prison for the past 9 years, and has had no relevance to the world of sports for decades. Yet so many of us continue to return to the well from his murder trial in the late 80s, hoping to squeeze some extra juice out of him. It may generate solid ratings for news networks, and a Twitter storm may unfold between sports media personalities, but that doesn't always make it a smart content play for a sports audience. Michael McCarthy of the Sporting News reports ESPN is interested in Charissa Thompson to work with Mike Greenberg on his upcoming morning show, which is scheduled to debut in January. Having worked in the same building with Greeny and as a PD which featured Mike and Mike, I respect him a lot. I want to see him do well. Many question if the new show will have enough sizzle to stand out in a crowded field, but with ESPN's muscle behind them, they'll have a chance to make inroads. If the goal, though, is to find the female with strong camera presence, wit, attitude, likability, and relatability, Katie Nolan checks those boxes. Charissa may have more experience and is undoubtedly very talented, but this is one of those times where it feels like ESPN has to take a risk to make some noise. Nolan is that wild card. Rather than taking a predictable path, I'm hoping ESPN explores a new way forward. Last week was a proud moment. My former APD and board op, Jeremiah Crow, was named the program director of KNBR in San Francisco. It's difficult for me personally to root for KNBR because I spent 4 years of my life competing hard against that radio station as PD of 95.7 The Game. But on a personal level, nothing pleases me more than seeing people grow in their careers. I'm a firm believer that a PD's job isn't just to generate ratings, ideas, and revenue. It's also to develop future leaders. I was fortunate enough to establish a PD tree by grooming two good ones in Jeremiah and Hoss Newpert at 101 ESPN. When I see others in the industry like John Goulet, Dan Ogden, Kyle Engelhart, Michelle Smallman, John Seymour, and Ben Boyd occupying important behind-the-scenes roles, it tells me maybe they paid a little bit of attention during our time together. When Jeremiah first flew out to San Francisco to discuss joining me, I told him, "Don't move here and take this job because of our friendship. Do it because you're interested and committed to becoming a program director." Over the next 4 years, I questioned him, challenged him, absolutely aggravated him, and it may have been hard at the time to see it, but it was all about making sure he'd be ready one day for a bigger stage. Now he has that chance and a deeper understanding of why PDs do certain things to get the best out of their people. I have no doubt he's going to do well. I just feel bad for Dan Ogden because he's about to get pushed harder than he ever thought possible, and he won't see the reward for a few years. That was the 5 and 5. Let me know your thoughts on any of the topics I brought to light. You can reach me by email at jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com or on Twitter at sportsradiopd. It's time to shift gears now to this week's conversation, and it features 95.7 The Game morning host Joe Fortenbaugh. Since arriving in San Francisco nearly 3 years ago, Joe has gained a ton of valuable on-air experience. In some ways, he's an anomaly because he landed a Market 4 drive time spot despite limited on-air experience. We went through the various chapters of his media career and explored a number of interesting issues about the industry, and I think you're going to enjoy what we created during the course of our 40 minutes together. 3, 2, 1. In college, you pursued a law degree, which led to working for a sports agency as an agent for a few years. Yet here you are now, hosting a sports talk radio show for a living. So it's not exactly the way you envisioned it, is it?
No, it's not. But I ended up in the world of sports, which was ultimately the goal. I remember I didn't even start at Penn State University for undergrad. I started at a school called Widener, which is about 2,000 kids in suburban Philadelphia. We are talking one of the worst neighborhoods imaginable. It's been on COPS twice. So there's very little you can do there as a student. And I screwed around a lot in high school, but I knew once I got to college, it was time to kind of throttle down to set up some opportunities. And I was never really 100% sure what I wanted to do in sports, but I wanted to be in sports. And I figured the best way to do that was to not only get an undergrad degree, but to get a law degree so that you could work with contracts. I've always been nerdy to the point where I'm kind of in the collective bargaining agreement and salary cap stuff. So I started with a pursuit of being an agent. And when I got to San Diego at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, I put together, and it's crazy to say this now because this was only in 2003, but a cover letter and my resume. And there's an agent in La Jolla, and his name was Jack Becta, and he had been in the game for like 30 years. So I figured this is going to be a good guy to learn from. So every single day for a month, as soon as I moved to San Diego, I mailed him this cover letter and resume. And the thought was, after a month, if I don't hear back, I'll start calling in addition to sending the letter. And then after a month of that, I'm just going to start showing up and force this guy to give me a job. I didn't want to get paid. I just needed a way in. And it was 26 or 27 letters before his number two called me and said, "Dude, enough. Just come on up. We'll have a conversation." And they started me with some low-level stuff, but it was 3 years of that under Jack Becta, and then bouncing around after law school before Jack pulled me out of minor league baseball. And started the website nationalfootballpost.com. And when he brought me onto that, that's what led me into the media. I got to learn how to do a little bit of podcasting, but a ton of writing. And the writing led to radio hits, and the radio hits led to a little bit of experience getting the name out there, which ultimately led to the job I have now.
Well, you mentioned National Football Post. I mean, what was it about that opportunity that made that job appealing to you?
The fact that it got me out of minor league baseball, to be completely honest with you. I had an opportunity to work for Jack as an agent, but it was going to be mostly commission-based, and coming out of law school, I'm six figures in debt, so I had to start earning as quickly as possible. So I end up back in Allentown, PA, but I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to get into sports. And the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs were just launching that year. They were the AAA affiliate of the Phillies. They were opening up. So I figure, all right, let's get a job with them, get some experience, figure something out. I hated minor league baseball. Now, I love the people. I hated the job because it was so many hours a day of just dealing with nonsense. There were so many people that they put you in this, it's called the customer service booth, but I called it the complaint booth because you just had people bitching about everything. So that drove me so nuts that I was at wit's end, and I was really thinking I was going to have to go take the bar exam to become a lawyer. But the reality was, just when I reached my breaking point about halfway into the season, Jack called up with the launch of NFP, and I was absolutely in. The chance to have some control over my work content, the chance to explore, to get into the internet game, that was huge for me. I jumped in. I didn't take a day off, and that includes Saturdays and Sundays for at least a year. That first year, I worked every single day.
Now, NFP allowed you to start getting your name out there. You started doing some radio call-ins around the country on local and national shows. You also made some in-studio appearances in the Las Vegas market. How did you get these radio stations to give you a shot when you were still relatively unknown? And why do you think it's important for younger people who are trying to establish themselves to do that?
Social media was a part of it, but I started with National Football Post in 2008. So Twitter was just coming onto the scene. I remember Gary Vaynerchuk was one of the bigger names on there, which he still is, but he didn't have millions of followers back then. There were so many people that didn't know about Twitter, and people weren't necessarily using Facebook for business and promotion in the manner they are now. Instagram didn't exist, Snap. I mean, none of that stuff was out there. So Twitter helped to an extent, but it was mostly radio stations reaching out to me because of the articles they saw that I was writing. National Football Post had some early prominence because of the names that were attached to the project. Michael Lombardi, who's worked for multiple teams as a general manager. Andrew Brandt, who's on ESPN, who's with Sports Illustrated, but he worked for the Green Bay Packers. Jack's a longtime agent. Former players like Matt Bowen, who can now be found at ESPN. These guys were big names that were able to draw a lot of attention to the site early on. So I was able, like that scuzzy fish that follows the shark around and eats whatever falls out of his mouth, that was me. I was able to grab some of that chum and catch some recognition based on what those guys were doing. I did a lot of fantasy stuff, so I that's where a lot of the radio hits started, but then some gambling stuff, and then just some overall opinion that would lead to hits, and then good performances, solid performances, energetic performances on those hits would lead to other opportunities.
I got to tell you, in all the time that I've spent on this podcast talking to personalities, I don't think I've ever had anyone refer to themselves as the scuzzy fish. So kudos to you for your uniqueness. Speaking of call-ins, when you're calling into a show and you're doing these hits around the country and you don't have a local market connection, what are some things you try to do to make sure it's a conversation that a local market's audience will remember and the local host will want you back on again? Because you mentioned the energy, and obviously that you can control, but from a content standpoint, you got to have a certain approach to it too, I'm sure.
Make them like me or make them hate me. I don't want them to be indifferent to me. If I'm on for 8 minutes and at the end of that 8 minute interview, you pull up to a red light and it's easy to forget about me, that's a failure on my behalf. I've got to get them to think. I've got to get them to laugh. I've got to get them to react. Now, that doesn't mean troll. That doesn't mean say anything purposefully incendiary to get them set off. I've done hits in Cleveland and in Oklahoma City, and since we're the Warriors flagship. So you can go on there and you could troll them easily. I'm never looking to do that. That's not going to be my style at any point. I want to be authentic, and I want to make my name based on just quality insight, hard work, and research. That's what I'm trying to get across. So if I'm going to make an appearance, say, in Philadelphia, I want to give them something to think about. I want to give them something that they haven't heard anywhere else, whether it be some angle, some piece of information they didn't even know about their own team, a reason why they're going to lose this weekend. Case in point, this was something we did last year. I was on in Kansas City, and we were previewing the Thursday night game in early December between the Raiders and the Chiefs. And they expect me to come on to be a homer. And I wasn't. I told them the bet of the year was their team, the Chiefs. And they start laughing and getting a kick out of it, but they had never heard this angle before, and it's something I had picked up in Vegas. Since 1996, right? So we're talking about 21 years. There have only been 12 games in which a road team played on a Thursday night after a Sunday game where they had to travel across two time zones, 1,500 or more miles. So Oakland on the road Thursday in Kansas City, it's more than 1,500 miles. It's across two time zones. They're on the road, and they played the previous Sunday. That situation, the home team is 12-1 straight up, 12-1 against the spread. That thing is a great trend, and that's what I dropped on the people in Kansas City. So they weren't going to think I was going to play homer. I told them. That was the bet of the year right there. Oakland was in a horrible spot. History showed us that, and sure enough, Kansas City covered.
So the dabbling in sports media starts with National Football Post. You start to make calls onto a number of shows. If memory serves me right, you did a hit with Cowherd at one point. I know Mully and Hanley have used you in Chicago for a while. But at that point, you hadn't been doing regular radio 5 days a week. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, I give you a call about a possible opportunity in San Francisco. And honestly, I had no idea if you'd be a fit for what we were looking to assemble at that time, because I knew that you hadn't done radio 5 days a week. But when I made that phone call, and you're in Las Vegas, haven't done a radio show, and I'm talking to you, this is Market 4, by the way. This isn't Market 40. Possible Market 4 opportunity in morning drive. What runs through your mind when that phone call comes in?
Well, first of all, it was Facebook. You reached out on Facebook.
That's right.
With a message. And I thought you were fucking with me. I honestly looked at this. See, I had a really wild day up until this point. I got to give you some context here. You reached out to me on a Saturday afternoon in the fall. Early in this day, I'm at my now wife, then girlfriend's house. Now, she's out of town. She's at a convention in Seattle, I believe. And I'm taking care of her dog and her cat. We weren't even living together at the time. And we've got this little patio that abuts Charleston Avenue in Las Vegas, which is one of the bigger arteries. Mm-hmm. So it's early on a Saturday morning, which means I'm in full degen mode. I've got a ton of college football action I'm going to be playing out throughout the day. And my opening game is Iowa and Maryland. Now, for the life of me, one of those two teams was a 2-touchdown favorite. I want to say Iowa. And I believe I was on the dog. And the way this game started was I was getting crushed, like right out of the gate. There were two scores that went against me, and it's like 9 in the morning, and I'm just sitting there going, is this going to be one of these days? And at the time, I was still smoking cigarettes. So I go out back, and I light up a smoke, and I'm like, let's just calm down. We'll figure this thing out. We got plenty of time to get back in this. And I hear screaming on the other side of the street. And we have this big wall that abutted our garden, which was right next to Charleston. So I look up over the wall, and I see across the street, this is, swear to God, 100% true, there's this woman, middle-aged, laying on the ground by the bus stop station, screaming and pointing. And there's this dude who just robbed her running down the street. And I've never seen anything like this before, so I couldn't believe it. So I don't know what it was about the scenario, but for some reason, and this isn't, you know, my nature, but I just figured I was going to follow this guy. I was going to do something about it. And I grab the cat, I grab the dog, I throw him back inside, I throw some shoes on, and I just jump over the wall. And I run across the street and quickly look at her to make sure she's okay. And then I just start jogging down the street. Now, quarter to a half mile down the street is a massive intersection. This guy would have been a fool. He had a huge lead on me, but he would have been a fool to stay on Charleston or to make a right or left, because you're on a major road either way. Someone's going to see you. So I just take an educated guess that he may have ducked into this giant shopping center parking lot. So I start walking through there. Sure enough, I see the dude. So now I don't even know what I'm going to do. I'm sure as hell not going to approach him, because I'm figuring it's some meth head or some moron in Vegas that's running around on a Saturday morning acting like a fool, which is what I've seen. So I follow the guy around. He goes and he makes a phone call. I call the police. I'm reporting everything. At one point, he actually comes up to me and asks if he can use my cell phone. Now, what I should have done was let him do it so we could have gotten the prints and figured out the number he's going to call.
Right.
But I didn't know what to do. So long story short, I just kind of update the police on all of this. I'm giving them a description. The car picks them up. I give them the license plate number. They disappear. And this girl picks them up. They fly out of the lot. I go back to the bus station. The woman's doing better. Someone else was helping her out. The police were there. I helped them with the police report. hug the woman. She's doing fine. Give the officers my number, all this nonsense. And, you know, you feel pretty good about yourself because you're thinking, all right, maybe I just helped someone out. Who knows? But I've never done anything like that. Cross the street, go back to the house. God immediately rewards me because whoever I bet on came back to score four straight touchdowns. They're covering the number. I end up winning the bet. Later that day, I'm riding so high. I'm at this bar called Born and Raised, which is down near the Mountain's Edge version of Vegas. And I was doing this fantasy TV show with two guys, and we had a Sunday morning show. So we were going over the notes and the show sheet and getting everything ready. And at the bar with my computer up, that's when I heard from you on Facebook. And I just thought you were fucking with me. But then I thought, look at this. I might be getting a huge break here. I just assumed the whole thing was based on karma.
You talk about karma. That is pretty impressive. I put you, Lorenzo Neal, and Chad Doing in a production studio to hear how you guys would sound, relate, and connect as a trio. You and Chad knew each other a little bit from you calling in on his show. Chad knew a little bit of Lorenzo, and you guys knew him as a player. But as a group, you guys didn't know each other well. You guys hadn't worked together. You're all in different pockets of the country. What do you remember that stood out from that audition process?
Wow. There was so much. It was such an overwhelming and surreal time. Lo is as charming an individual as you would expect. And Chad was every bit as generous and gracious as I remember from doing his show in Portland all those years. It was such a big, big thing because there was such a combination of emotion, wide range of emotion that was taking place. You know, on one hand, you're nervous. You're nervous like you've never been nervous before because you really want this gig. But there's so much uncertainty. I barely knew the city of San Francisco at that time. I had been there only twice. And of all the cities I've traveled to and been around, very little did I know about the Bay Area. Very little. So, I mean, I'm in this new city. I'm working with guys that I had never met face to face. I'm auditioning for the job of my dreams now because this is something you realize after working in the media long enough that radio was where I wanted to be. I was overprepared for content, but totally underprepared for conversation. You had given us a rough idea of what we were going to discuss for the hour. So I just immersed myself in all that. And the content was fine. But in terms of the conversation, I was always a guy who it was wait to talk, don't listen, try to make every sentence a big time sentence. And through time, you need to learn the idea of it's the conversation that matters. It's not so much the take every single time. It's the conversation. You can take a bad topic and get people to listen if the conversation's solid. Conversely, you can take a great topic and get people to not listen if the conversation's garbage. So I remember three guys being very nervous, just trying to find their way. And then Lowe made a joke about black guys and fried chicken. And that ended up just lightening the whole mood for the rest of the day.
That's one thing about Lorenzo Neal. For those who are listening to this podcast and aren't familiar with him, I encourage you, check out 957thegame.com. Listen to the show one morning because your initial perception will be hard-hitting fullback, you know, probably just a football guy, but he's got some sneaky things he'll throw your way that you won't see coming from time to time, and they literally will have you busting a gut when you hear him. So Chad, Joe, and Lowe is born. You start out initially in the number two chair, which for the listeners right now, the igniter is essentially the number two guy. He's the one depended on in a show to deliver strong, passionate opinions, fire up the room, provoke the audience, all that. What about that role was most comfortable and challenging for you at that point?
That's me. I didn't have to worry about any of the stuff that comes with a radio gig. The host is going to handle the ins, the outs, the reads. There was nothing in there that I necessarily need to worry about that changed who I was from before working in radio to after working in radio. I just needed to make sure the microphone was on and I was prepared to go when it was thrown to me. And then from that point, I got to do what I've always done, just give my opinion. I think at first, one thing that obviously is going to hurt me is I wasn't local. I wasn't born and raised in the Bay Area. So you're really going to have to earn people's trust through a variety of avenues. But the upside is that I didn't walk in worried about offending any teams or offending any individuals or writers or people who had been around for a long time. Now, that doesn't mean I tried to go scorched earth, but if I had an opinion on the Niners, I was going to share it. I wasn't beholden to them in any way, shape, or form. You didn't create an environment where we had to cowtail to the teams. There is a healthy respect for the teams under you, don't get me wrong, but we didn't feel compelled to say certain things just to make sure everyone was happy. We got to be honest and we got to be who we are. And that was the part that got me out of the gates right from the beginning. I didn't need to change much of my personality. Now, I needed to slow down, and I needed to avoid being so statistically heavy because that's something I've always leaned upon. And in time, I've been able to do that. But early on, I got to be me, and that was the biggest key. I didn't have to worry about offending the Oakland A's or offending the Golden State Warriors or offending the Raiders in any way, shape, or form. I got to say what I wanted to say, and as long as it was truthful and authentic, I would always be able to stand by it.
Now, they say you haven't worked in radio until you've undergone some adversity, and you got a little bit of this right after I brought you in, because literally 2 months after you come in for an audition, I'm informing the whole crew I'm leaving. So now you've went to work for somebody in a market that you're not familiar with. You're involved with two guys on a morning show who you're still getting to know. And then here's the guy who reached out to you on Facebook who's telling you, hey, by the way, I'm leaving. And like with any change, a new guy is going to come in. He's going to have a different style, personality. But the job behind the microphone still doesn't change. But when someone in our business is going through one of those situations, what advice can you pass along to them that you've learned while going through that?
Quiet the noise around you. Figure out what really matters. And the only thing that matters is what you can control in those environments. Now, sure, you're going to have to play the political game to an extent. Anytime someone new comes in, you want to forge a positive relationship. You want to get off on the right foot. You want to have a good first impression. But for me, it's always really boiled down to a couple key things. You can say what you want about my temperament, my personality. You can say what you want about me in any way, shape, or form. Two things you're never going to be able to question are my work ethic and my preparation. I'm always going to be the first guy in every morning. I'm always going to be the last one from my show to leave. And I'm always going to be more prepared than anyone else in the business. That doesn't mean there are people who don't prepare well. That doesn't mean there are people who don't show up early or leave late. You're just not going to beat me. My thought process has always been, if you know I'm in first, if you know I'm out last, you know I care, and you know I put every ounce of energy I have into preparing for that show, it's going to be very difficult for you to find someone to replace me with. Maybe you want a different style. Maybe I rub people the wrong way. I could get that. But you're never going to be able to say I was lazy. You're never going to be able to say I don't work hard. And that would be the advice I throw out there. There's so many people, and sadly, this happens a lot with the younger generation, it feels, but there are so many people out there that are constantly looking to cut corners. They're constantly looking for that, hey, let's work smarter, not harder. Yeah, I'm all for efficiency, but I'm not for the little hustles to try to get one up on everybody else. Get your ass in, work hard, and go home and do whatever you want. So as long as I have that as my reputation, I'm going to lean on that for the rest of my days. There's never going to be a guy who can doubt the work ethic or doubt the commitment. And if you've got that to stand on, you've got a real good chance of making a solid impression. And then you've just got to figure out a way to get along with people. That's actually been the biggest trick for me, is being affable, being likable, being someone that you want to be around in the office, because I come off as a relatively intense dude, and I don't have a lot of time for nonsense. I really don't want to waste my time with small talk or bullshit or any of the other stuff that a lot of people go through day to day in the office. I want to get in, I want to handle it as well as I can, and I want to get out. Not because I'm in a rush to get out, but because there's something else to do. There's another way to get better. There's something else to learn, whether it's with your family, whether it's with your business. There is something that can be done. So I'm not big on small talk, even though I do a lot of talking, just because it just feels like a waste of time.
That's excellent advice. I mean, and we were talking about adversity. You went through some more of it, because after I left about, I don't know, a little under a year, the station made a tough call. They parted ways with Chad Doing, added Dan Dibley to the morning show. With that change, you were required to move from the number two chair into the driver's seat, the number one chair. When you're going through that kind of role change, what did you do to prepare for that adjustment?
Study. And through me, it's studying other radio hosts and people in the business. I can't even tell you how many podcasts I was listening to, how many different radio stations I was studying. This was a completely foreign role for me. I had, I think, a grand total of maybe 3 days worth of reps in the A chair prior to that. I had never hosted a pregame show, a postgame show. I had never hosted anything. I got a couple hours filling in for some guys during middays when they went on vacation, just to get an idea of what it would be like to do 2 hours by myself. And I got two of those. And then I had a day where I hosted, I think, just with Lowe. And that was it. It was a grand total of maybe 10 hours of A chair experience before we were taking on this new task 5 days a week, 4 hours a day, working with one guy I had never worked with before, and at the start of football season, which is when we've got to be able to make it rain because you want to crush it then heading into Warriors season. So for me, it was studying other styles. Colin Cowherd, Dan Le Batard, Dan Patrick, just anybody. Anybody who's been around a long time, listening to how they get in and out of breaks, listening to how they set up their teases, listening to how they transition from one topic to another, listening to how the personality at one point can be very hot, but at the next point can cool down depending on what's being discussed. It was really just a matter of aggregating guys who have had a ton of success and listening to as much as I could while taking notes and trying to figure out, okay, this is how you might want to start the top of the hour. This is how you want to segue. This is how you get other people involved. Because again, a lot of the people I named are one-man acts.
Right.
Well, I was working on a three-man show, so I needed to learn how to share the rock, set guys up, make sure the situation was workable for everybody. So it was trial and error, and there was a lot of patience I needed to display early on to avoid frustration and also to make sure, you know, it was a nice working environment. Because that's the thing. You can get so caught up in making sure your performance is solid. You can get so caught up in making sure the hosting elements are handled. You might forget that people aren't having fun, or people are bored, or people are upset, or they feel underutilized. So then you've got to take on this management capacity as well to make sure everyone around is operating at an optimum level. So it's a constant learning experience, and I relish it. But from where I was to where I am now, in about a year's time, there's been some growth, and there's room for a lot more as well.
Now, one other area you've gained experience at since I left is having more knowledge in what's in front of you as far as local competition is concerned. Because when you first got there and I was on the way out, I mean, you're just trying to learn the job. You're not thinking about who you're going up against. But as you know, in San Francisco, you're going up against a dominant heritage brand with a big signal. Many broadcasters in the business go through that challenge every day in different cities, you know, going up against a heritage brand that's had a 20-year or 25-year head start. What have you learned that might be helpful to someone in a similar spot who's trying to figure out how to establish your own product, yet make inroads against a strong market competitor?
Well, there's two elements to that, one of which is kind of like a statistical strategy point of view. I never understood when I got in the business. I mean, I was so raw. I never understood clocks, how they worked. I never heard of it. I didn't get the concept. And you learn relatively quickly, you know, this is when you're on, this is the commercial break. But setting up clocks to potentially put yourself in a better situation over the competition. So if you know this is a baseball heavy town, and this is something you taught me, if this is a baseball heavy town and you know that a lot of people are going to be listening to the competitor from say 7:30 to 8 for baseball coverage, and then the competitor is going to go away for 6, 7, 8 minutes of commercials, they flip over to you, why not give them more baseball coverage? Why not tee it up so that you can grab all those people based on what they were just listening to? You can fill that void. And hopefully you can hang on to them long enough so that you grab the quarter hour, but you also grab a new listener. Maybe not a P1, but someone who's willing to give you another shot down the road. So there's the strategy behind figuring out where your opponent may be weak and how you can capitalize just from a clock's perspective, just from a timing perspective, just from a topic perspective. Then on the other side, there's the patience that comes with realizing, look, we might have an opportunity to catch these guys or take them down, but it's going to take work. This type of stuff doesn't happen overnight. The biggest thing that stands out to me about San Francisco is that I grew up in the Philadelphia area. So between the two stations there, you've got guys yelling and screaming back and forth. They've got no problem trying to cut each other down, trying to go to war with one another. Here in the Bay, I was fully ready to get into something like that. That's not how people are, though. Mm-hmm. People aren't looking for one radio station to call out the other. They're not looking for an on-air battle. They're not looking for a rivalry. It is so laid back here. It is so calm. I remember it was 2 years in the business before I was even in the same room, really, as the morning show guys from across the street.
I'll tell you this, because when we built the station, we did that the first year. And it definitely worked to generate buzz. Like, we ran these promos of, you know, AM versus FM, basically saying this is old and busted, this is the new school and a better way of doing it. It's hard to justify doing that for a long stretch of time. So to your point, and just in general, people in San Francisco are a lot more laid back, relaxed. They like to go out, enjoy a game. They're not, you know, freaking out because the third base coach sent the runner from third in the third inning of a game, right, in May. It's just a different world. They're not like the East Coast, which is a lot more, hey, show me something today, and if you do it today, I want to see it again tomorrow. It's just a different atmosphere and environment.
Yeah, the sky is never falling here. I mean, when Kevin Durant got hurt, it was a hot day for radio because you could have a great conversation and talk it out. But no one really was, that wasn't going to alter their life. They were still going to go outside and enjoy great weather. They were still going to see the water, cross the bridge, have food that rivals some of the best in the world. I think it was Eric Davis who told me this once. This is a famous line from his. Now, I didn't work with him at 95.7, but he was there prior to me. And it was one of those questions where I asked, Edie, I'm a big college football guy, but nobody talks college football in the Bay. Why doesn't it resonate? And he looks at me and he just goes, people have better shit to do on a Saturday. They have better shit to do. They've got wine country. They've got Big Sur. They've got Lake Tahoe. They've got so much going on. They got better shit to do than sit in front of the TV for 14 hours watching college football. And that was heartbreaking to me because that's all I had ever done my entire life. But at the same time, now that I've lived here for almost 3 years, I get it. I get what it's like here. It takes some time. But once you figure out the city, you realize it's a completely different ecosystem than what you're used to dealing with in other regions of the country. This leads me back to my point. I would have loved the idea of going head to head with the competitors and getting into verbal wars with these guys. With law school training, with my personality in general, I feel like I can go head to head with anyone in that realm. But then I'm at an event once where, you know, Murph and Mac, they're the competitors. They were there. They're the nicest guys in the world. Like, I remember shaking hands with these guys thinking, these are supposed to be your competitors. You're supposed to hate these guys, but how do you do it? They're nice guys. They lead good lives. You know, people like them. And you're competing with them and you want to take them down, but there's no ill will there. This is San Francisco. You know, no one hates each other. Everyone goes about their business. There's plenty of room, but there is that competitive spirit. They know you're coming for them and they're prepared for it. And you know, you're going after them and you got to take these guys down. They've been on top for a long time. So I think it's more friendly spirited competition than anything else. But that was the thing that caught me off guard, because growing up in Philly and, you know, listening to what goes on at WFAN with him and his competitors, there's so much of that on the East Coast, guys just going at each other. And here it's much more laid back.
So let's talk a little bit about your own improvement. When it comes to being able to measure whether or not you've made strides and where you feel you're getting stronger and where you feel you're still weak, how do you ultimately determine where you are in terms of your own development and the certain parts of your presentation that have to be stronger?
Self-assessment, I'll go back and listen, or air checks, and that's mostly for tempo and tone. I'm somewhat of an acquired taste, especially here. Louder, I speak very fast, it can be aggressive, it can feel like there's a negative connotation, but it's an honest connotation, to be honest with you. And if I go back and listen, I want to hear that I've slowed my pace from when I originally started, because I used to talk a mile a minute and now I've brought it down a little bit. I've also brought down the edge a little bit, because moving from the B chair to the A chair, you've got to be a little bit more likable. You can still have that edge, but you've got to be more affable. You've got to be a little bit more entertaining than edgy at times because you're hosting the show. So I can go back and I can assess those things. But in terms of whether or not the content's good, in terms of whether or not the content's working, you need additional insight. And you can't go to your parents or your wife or your friends, because they're biased. They like you. They're going to give you positive feedback. That's not what I'm looking for. If I have a great idea, I don't want people to tell me it's a great idea. I want them to poke holes in it so I can figure out how to make it an even better idea. That's the point of feedback. I don't need anyone saying that was a really nice segment. Well, it felt good, so I knew that. What I need is someone saying right here, you missed the spot to really take this conversation to the next level. And that's the best way for me to work on getting better. Having coaching, having feedback, having individuals I trust who know that I've got thick skin and that they can be very candid with me so that I can work towards getting better. That's the key. Self-assessment for tempo and tone, and then bringing in someone from the outside to overall evaluate the product.
So one challenge that all hosts face is trying to decide whether to focus on the things they care about personally or talk about the things that the audience values. And that's a constant struggle. In your market, you've got two baseball teams, two football teams, so that plays into it too, because Giants fans are very different than A's fans. Same with Raiders and Niners fans. How do you guys determine which content you're going to feature in your program every day?
When you're the king, you can talk about whatever you want, because you're going to rate based on the fact that you're the king. People are coming to hear you. They're not necessarily coming to hear the content. We, and myself especially, are not in that boat yet. people aren't necessarily coming to hear strictly what I have to say. They want to hear good content. So the strategy is always going to be sports early, sports often, sports heavy. What are people talking about? Some guys like to get in the lifestyle. Some guys will like to talk about movies and things that are going on. And it is nice at times to pull back the curtain and let people peek into your life. It can be entertaining. It can serve a variety of positive purposes. But the bottom line is, if someone's tuning in to our sports station, the likelihood is they want to hear about sports. So give them sports. When the election rolls around, maybe you touch on it for a minute to address the fact that it's the biggest story in the country. But be smart, be creative, find a way to tie it into sports. Find a way to tie the whole thing to local sports so that you can deliver something really powerful and unique. That's the point. So for us, that's a battle we have because we're the A's flagship, but the A's rate nowhere near the Giants rate, even though the Giants are having a tough season. So you've got to find a way to deliver. You want the listeners to get what they want, but you've also got bosses you've got to answer to, and you've got to deliver the numbers. So if you're the king, again, you can talk about whatever you want, but I'm not there. So it's all about finding compelling conversation. I think the one thing that I learned more than anything else from listening to someone, it was Colin Cowherd maybe a year ago, and it was a 4 or 5 minute segment he did on the Patriots signing Chris Long. Mm-hmm. Now, let's be honest, that wasn't national news. That's not a big story. Chris Long's a little bit past his prime, and this was a signing that came, you know, out of left field in a dead time of year. It was nothing. It was nothing. I don't even know how big a deal that was on WEEI or the Sports Hub in Boston. I don't even know if they're going to run with that. But for some reason, Colin brought that into his national show, and he did 4 minutes on it. And it was 4 minutes about how Belichick, he draws this analogy where Belichick's like the bad boy boyfriend who he finds you, he meets you, he likes you, he winds you and dines you, you have a great time with them, you know, he gets the most out of you, you feel like you're your absolute best, and just when you think you're in love and you're going to be married, and that's the Super Bowl, he goes ahead and he cuts you and he moves on. And you're heartbroken and devastated, but he got what he needed out of you and now he's moving on. That has resonated with me for more than a year because this is a guy who took a story that was virtually meaningless. It wasn't a headline anywhere. Nobody cared. And he got 4 minutes of quality radio out of it because he drew a little analogy. He made you think, he enlightened you, and then he moved on. That has always stuck with me. The true pros, the best of the best, can take anything and make it listenable. That's what I'm always striving to be. I want you to be able to give me the worst possible topic. The last guy to make the AAA squad coming out of spring training, and I want to be able to give you 5 minutes on that that you will listen to from start to finish. Once you reach that point, you know you've got something cooking.
Well, another issue, which has become a big topic of conversation in sports media circles, it's one that you've got a lot of experience at, is sports handicapping. We've seen networks like ESPN start to dip their toe into a little deeper in the water, but they haven't fully gone in there just yet. Why do you think they should or shouldn't start featuring sports betting more prominently on television and radio?
Well, because if you're going to be ignorant to it, you shouldn't feature it at all. Don't talk about it. Don't cover it. Just to cover it. Cover it because you care about it. Cover it because you can deliver something on it. Anyone can go out and give a pick. But if you're going to cover sports wagering, educate the people who are listening to you. Because this is a serious topic, right? You educating someone on the training camp roster battles, you have to realize as a radio host, that's information these guys are going to take into their conversations with their friends. You need to put them in a position where if they're going to back one wide receiver over another, they're going to sound good. They're going to sound right. They're going to be agreeing with you. They're going to use your info. So you want them sounding good in their conversation so that they come back and continue to consume your product. Same thing with sports betting, although there's even more of a responsibility because now you're going to have individuals who are going to be financially benefiting or hurting because of the information you portray. So you've got to educate people on how the game works. You've got to educate people on the best way to play the game and the best way to beat the game. You also have to educate people that they're going to lose and that they've got to be able to handle losing, both emotionally and financially. People don't understand the Kelly criterion. People don't understand bankroll management. You have a responsibility that if you're going to throw picks out there and tell them, this is my lock of the week, take it right to the bookie, we'll also teach them about money management. If they bet $20 a game, regularly and they can handle that, don't hype the pickup to the point where you call it, oh, it's the 401k play of the week, get $500 on it. That's going to hurt the guy. So if we're moving towards legalization, that's fantastic. And I love the fact that there's a brighter light being shined on this. But if you're going to cover it, educate the people and cover it right. Do not be lazy. Do not go with some of the slime ball pick sellers who are out there trying to hustle you with snake oil. Find the guys who know what they're talking about and lean on them, because you do have a responsibility to your audience.
I mean, based on your experience, do you think there's 50% of the audience value sports handicapping content? Is it 75? Is it 25? What's your take on how passionate people are to hear that?
It'll depend upon the time of year. If you're coming out on a Tuesday in May trying to give information on the best baseball games that are taking place in the AL Central between Minnesota and Detroit, I don't know if you're going to be able to hold an audience. But we all know during Super Bowl week, everywhere you look, everybody knows the point spread. Everybody knows the over-under, and everybody knows some of the best props out there. Everybody knows about gambling and brackets when it comes to March Madness. People know about it during the national championship game in football. Play it to your audience and understand time of year. It's like any other topic. You know, if the Giants are the hottest team in the Bay Area to talk about them at the top of the hour and in drive time. If the Sharks, even though, God bless them, they're making a run in the playoffs, aren't going to move the meter, maybe you don't come out at 7:30 talking about the Sharks. Same thing with sports betting. Fridays going into an NFL weekend, yeah, we do a Beat the Bookie segment. I've been doing it for the last 2 years, and it's something that resonates. But if I was doing Beat the Bookie in March going into an NBA weekend, I don't think you're necessarily going to hold an audience, because those on the outside are going to view that as just straight up degenerate play. Whereas going into Super Bowl week, that's common practice. Going into the Kentucky Derby, that's common practice. We're all used to that.
I'm going to throw a little bit of a curve your way with this next question, because you're originally from Pennsylvania, grew up a big Philadelphia sports fan. And usually when you first get a job in radio, you're just thrilled to be there and you value where you are, but you really don't think about long-term where you want to be. But with those roots back home in Pennsylvania and your passions for Philadelphia sports, how much thinking have you done now that you've had 2.5, 3 years on the radio about maybe one day talking sports for a living in the city of Philadelphia?
I thought about talking sports in Seattle, in Miami, in San Diego, back in Las Vegas, in Chicago. My wife and I have had these discussions all over. We're very nomadic people. She grew up in New York. I grew up in Philly. We met in Las Vegas. We were both living there. She's been in Chicago. I've been in Florida and San Diego. And now we're both in the Bay Area together. So early on, there's more of a pull elsewhere because it's young, it's exciting. You know, you think about opportunities and where you eventually want to settle down. And now we've been here for about 3 years. We got married while living here. We had a kid 6 months ago while living here. And you start to put down roots. And early on, there isn't much attaching you to the place because, number one, we don't have family here. And number two, you're the guy that brought me in. You're not even here anymore.
Right.
So I don't even have a connection professionally to a lot of people. But as you start to gain a foothold in the market, you start to realize how difficult it is to connect with people, how difficult it is to get them to trust you. I might be from Allentown, Pennsylvania, but even if they brought me into Philadelphia to do sports talk radio, I don't think many people know who I am there.
Right.
You'd still have to win that audience over. And you might be from the area, but that doesn't mean they're going to buy into whatever it is you have to say. So it's the most important thing is valuing what you have and not assuming the grass is always greener. It did take a while to adjust to life in San Francisco. There was a lot going on with us. And when you're working in morning radio, you're totally changing your body's clock. So there, you have to keep that in mind as well. There's a lot psychologically going on, physically, mentally, emotionally. But once you start to put down roots, I'd say the only thing that hurts my opinion of this area is the fact that it costs more than any other spot in the country. There's always that thought in the back of your mind that if you had an opportunity on a Monday to come out after a huge Eagles win or to be a guy on air the minute the Sixers finally get back into the playoffs, what that would mean, because you grew up with that. You know, this is my adopted home. That was my original home. And there's pros and cons to both. But yeah, you always think about what that would be like, because you don't even feel like you would have to prepare anything. You could just show up and be emotional for 4 hours and it would work.
All right, I want to wrap up with something I do called quick hits. 4 quick questions. The first thought that pops into your mind on each question, okay?
Got it.
The Raiders in Las Vegas long-term is a good or bad bet?
Bad. It's bad because No one can explain to me where that city is going to get their water from in 20 years. And once the economy tanks again, like it did in 2008, we know what's going to happen. Financially, that team is really going to hurt. The people who are there, great people. They're going to support the product early on. But to leave a fan base of 7 million with outside cities, to go to a place at max with 2 million and no surrounding cities, you're setting yourself up for a very tough run.
The one sports host doing it better than anyone else who you make a point to either watch or listen to regularly is...
I would have to go with Colin Cowherd there. There are a lot of guys out there, but I'm drawn to him. I'm drawn to his creativity because I think he's able, like we talked about earlier, to make mountains out of molehills. He's able to take something that nobody else would run with, and he makes that compelling content. I still got to give him the edge. I think he's the best in the game.
If Donald Trump was a sports radio host, how successful would he be?
You know what? I don't think he'd be that successful because if you need to hear from him 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, he doesn't come across as someone who prepares. He's got a limited vocabulary. Now, he says incendiary things and he gets people going, but that seems like it happens in short bursts. Has anyone ever sat down and listened to Trump speak for 2 hours straight on air? No, you hear him for 30 seconds going off on a debate platform, and then you get someone else, and then he goes off again. So I think it would be hot at first, but I don't think he'd be able to sustain long term.
And finally, if you're betting on one thing becoming a larger part of sports media in the next few years, what is it?
Podcasting. I would say podcasting, and then whatever version we're going to see of podcasting that ends up being video. Podcasting is huge. For guys in radio, you're thinking like the guys in newspapers are. You're wondering if these opportunities will dry up because of what's happening in the podcasting game. Cars are moving over to computers. You've always got to be thinking about the direction your industry's headed. The podcasting game continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Everybody's got a podcast. Now the question is going to be, who can be the best at podcasting?
He is Joe Fortenbaugh. You can hear him weekday mornings on 95.7 The Game in the Bay Area. You could also find him on Twitter at Joe Fortenbaugh. Joe, it's been a blast. I appreciate the time today. Good luck with the show, and we'll talk again soon.
Anything for you, JB. You're the one that gave me the shot. So anytime you call, I'm emotionally obligated to say yes to these things. No, I'm just kidding, man. It's always a blast. Thanks for having me.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
That was Joe Fortenbaugh of 95.7 The Game in San Francisco. Hope you enjoyed listening to that. There were so many different things there that took place, from the robber story and how karma seemed to work to his benefit when I reached out initially for the San Francisco opening, to learning how to perform in the number two chair versus what he has to do differently as a number one, to the subject of sports handicapping and the way it's gained momentum in recent years to become a bigger conversation on sports media outlets. I think the fact that professional sports has embraced Las Vegas and put two professional franchises there adds to it. And now you see SiriusXM has a full channel dedicated to it. So as we move forward, I think that's only going to continue to pick up steam. And obviously in Joe's case, he's pretty well equipped to provide that kind of content on the air. But that's going to conclude this episode. My thanks again to Joe Fortenbaugh and to each of you for spending your time listening. In the next week, I'm going to be posting on Twitter and Facebook asking for some of my sports radio friends to help me reach some of their listeners. I'm looking to conduct some research on what audiences across the country seek and reject most from sports radio stations. The help along the way allows me to gain insights that benefit us all in the industry. A quick reminder, I consult for stations and perform in-market training to help brands and their people grow. In fact, two of my clients are nominated this year for Marconi Awards. To find out how I can make a difference for your company, email me at jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. In the words of Kid Rock, if it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it looks good, you'll see it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. So be authentic in everything you do. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.